some pharmaceutical company came up with a drug that could temporarily reduce feelings of both anxiety and loneliness while enhancing motivation and self-esteem without actually making the user intoxicated, you know it would be a blockbuster. It hasn't happened yet, but we can give ourselves a dose of something very similar almost any time we want, because all those mind and mood-enhancing effects happen when we engage in something that brings us joy. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Although we live in a world that preaches against having too much fun, my guest says we can program doses of it into our lives right alongside conference calls and dentist visits. That's right, we can schedule time for fun with no guilt because it's good for us. Mike Rucker is an organizational psychologist and a charter member of the International Positive Psychology Association. His book is called The Fun Habit: How the Pursuit of Joy and Wonder Can Change Your Life. Mike, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me. That might be one of the best intros I've ever had, so I'm really grateful.
I'm glad to hear it. It's an age-old thing, right, for people to want happiness, but it's a pretty new idea to think about happiness as a kind of skill. Does this mean we can learn to make ourselves happy?
I kind of frame it a little bit different. I think the pursuit of happiness is what starts to become problematic, right? Because really focusing on happiness is this act of evaluation. And so my subtle shift, and again, these are essentially just playing with constructs, right, is that having a focus on fun takes a more action-oriented approach. And so instead of taking ourselves out of the moment to sort of reflect, is this making me happy? We essentially just engage in the things that we actually find a connection with, you know, the things that bring us joy. Or if there's a course correction, as you alluded to in the intro, that needs to happen because your life is devoid of joy for whatever reason. And, you know, there's a bunch of headwinds that we might get into later for that to happen. But, you know, whether it's a course correction or it's just being deliberate about how you spend your time, having these moments of joy that you engage in through your own agency and autonomy becomes extremely important, especially here in the West where, you know, study after study shows that so many of us are not engaging in leisure.
So we can set aside, you know, the forest of happiness and focus on the trees, which are fun and joy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I oftentimes lean a lot on the research of Dr. Iris Mouse out of Cal, but her research has been replicated by others. And what we found to be problematic is that it's not necessarily going out and living a joyful life, but it's that rumination on whether or not I'm happy, right? And so what becomes problematic is, you know, this concern of happiness rather than living a happy life. And so, you know, happiness essentially becomes this lagging indicator if you're already kind of focused on it, right? Am I happy? We're taking an action-oriented approach and essentially just, you know, finding opportunities for fun tends to be a leading indicator. As you index these memories, you start to realize that, yeah, life is actually worth living.
How does fun play into the development of our brains starting in infancy?
So it's really used as a tool for development, right? I think anybody that sees, you know, kids play in the park, even, you know, mammals play at, you know, like dogs at a dog park, understand that, you know, sort of these joyful moments are how we start to make sense of the world, right? We start to storm and form and norm around these games. We figure out, you know, what friendships mean to us and how social connection sort of increases, you know, the neurochemicals that make us feel good. And so at the very onset, it's a great tool to sort of understand the environment around us.
You think about kids turning just about anything they can find into a toy, or very little kids just running everywhere because it feels good and it's fun. How is it so many of us forget this ability we had as children?
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, some of my original research is that we have these heuristics that we need to essentially operate an adult life, right? I mean, more and more we have a deluge of information coming at us all the time, and life is becoming more complex, certainly a lot more complex from the advent of smartphones, right? Because essentially we're getting notifications and information coming to us from all angles. And so because of that, we become a lot more linear with regards to how we operate in life. And so we need these opportunities, these invitations to be able to get outside of those algorithms to really, you know, operate in a playful space, in a creative space. And so one of the phenomenons that I saw as I studied children's play areas around the North Carolina area, and you would see kids, you know, you kind of alluded to this earlier, you would see kids rush in and immediately know how to have fun, right? These would be these experiential play areas, and they would start to grab, you know, play blocks, and they would start to see, you know, who their friends are going to be almost immediately, and, you know, greet each other with a smile and start to figure out the rules of engagement, where parents would slowly sort of back up into the walls, right. Because they didn't know what to do, right? It's like, we're so wanting instruction, because that's how we've, you know, learned to operate within this life. And it also makes things easier, right? So there's a reason for it. I'm not necessarily, you know, villainizing adulthood. I mean, we need these things so that we have shortcuts or life would become extremely overwhelming, but they do get in the way, right? And so, you know, a lot of times in those particular situations, once they're sort of invited to play, like oftentimes they'll ask the proprietor of the space, like, what am I supposed to do? And there'll be this kind of chuckle and shoulder shrug. And it's like, you just go out there and have fun. And half the time they'll just do that. You know, they'll sort of take their kids' lead, which is oftentimes what I suggest to do, because kids are great teachers. What you see sometimes in the other direction, which is unfortunate, this comes from the science of transactional analysis, is that parents will go in there and start to try and kind of be an adult or teach, right? They go right back into that linear mode and they're like, let's build a house. And then you'll kind of see the kid retract, right? Because, oh, I get it. This isn't meant to be fun. This is meant to be you trying to teach me how to make a house, which is really unfortunate. So I would suggest to anyone that's listening, especially that has kids, they can be, you know, a great source of sort of rediscovering, you know, your playful spirit, because they're still in that mode, right? And so allow yourself to be more childlike. And obviously, if the child needs course correction, go back into adult mode, right? I'm not suggesting that you live a life of whimsy, but I certainly think, and there's a host of empirical research to suggest that when we are able to get in these states, what they allow us to do is free ourselves from those heuristics. And oftentimes, that's the space where you can solve problems, right? I mean, that's why, you know, whenever we're able to calm our mind, whether it's through fun or playfulness, or even just silence, like in the shower or on a walk, we tend to get some of our best ideas, because it really frees us to be able to coalesce things that aren't necessarily categorically related, you know, and kind of get outside the linear fashion in the way we see the world.
Before we get too far into this, I do want to let folks know, you tell us here, we shouldn't expect to be having fun all the time. We won't be happy all the time. What is the value in the experience of occasionally feeling dissatisfied?
Yeah, so this work comes from Barbara Fredrickson, and it really, you know, the idea is broaden and build. And so if you sort of over optimize for anything, right, then you don't have this breadth of experience. And a lot of how we experience pleasure and happiness really is comparing, you know, the breadth of our experiences. And so unfortunately, loss and, you know, other areas of misfortune, you know, do happen in life, and being able to actualize that, sit with it, process it, and accept it becomes important elements, because when you don't take the time to do that, you don't really build resilience. And it also doesn't give you that platform to really enjoy the things that are positive in your life.
You write about some fascinating research here that suggests planning fun activities pays dividends, not just during and after the fact, but before. What happens when we're anticipating a good time?
Yeah, so one of the interesting things we found out about dopamine, you know, and again, leaning on some really wise people, interviewed different neuroscientists for this, is that, you know, this idea that it's a pleasure neurochemical is sort of outdated. And what we now know is that dopamine, that excitement that we get from, you know, getting that hit, is really in anticipation of pleasure. And so, you know, getting to sit with things that are going to excite us in the future really can be a pleasurable way to sort of savor things before they happen. And then I also suggest in the book that you can do the same thing by savoring things after the moment through reminiscing.
How does our tendency to compare ourselves to other people affect our perception of fun and pleasure?
Yeah, so there's this concept called the hedonic treadmill. And what's unfortunate is that if we're not mindful about what really lights us up, oftentimes we become victims to comparing ourselves to others. And that's just kind of natural, right? And so I share in the book that it's not necessarily, you know, all of us want to conquer all, but there is this sort of inherent human nature that if we're not mindful of it, always want us to kind of climb that ladder, right? And especially here in the West, where we've been socially normalized around living in a meritocracy, right? It's kind of like, okay, this is what we do. We always kind of want to achieve that next thing. And where that can become problematic is that if you're always comparing yourself to, you know, sort of the next social strata, then you're never satiated. And so the people that kind of take a step back and go, what is it that I really want? And once I arrive, I can really enjoy, you know, that thing. And generally, either that's a connection to spirituality. Some folks, it's, you know, connection to nature. Some, it's their social connection. Some, you know, it's mastery of a hobby. For instance, my father is a musician. So, you know, that is just something that's an endless well of enjoyment for him. So, you know, those things are the things that really light us up. But if we're not mindful in that way, oftentimes, you know, we get something that becomes ephemeral and then, you know, we sort of move on because that is just a component of human nature. We sort of want to see where we are within the tribe.
We know that fun feels really good. What's happening chemically in our brains when we're in the moment, very present, having fun?
Yeah, I think, you know, oxytocin and dopamine are released, especially if we feel a connection with others and we're having fun with others. And so a few things we know, you know, once we're able to sort of marinate in this is that our empathy increases and that we also, you know, whether you call it willpower or ego depletion, we build more resilience with regards to doing the harder things. And so at a neurochemical level, that's what's happening. There's also a psychological concept called the hedonic flexibility principle, which suggests that, and this was a huge sample size, the study came out of MIT, Harvard, and Stanford, that when, the sample size was, I think, over 20,000 people, what they found is that if we're not having fun, then we look for forms of escapism that generally don't really lead to betterment, right? It might be something like going out and drinking or, you know, things like, you know, casual social media use, things of that nature. The folks that are engaged in active leisure, you know, and really taking time off the table for themselves are able to come back the next day and do the harder stuff. They're the ones that have, you know, reinstilled that vigor and vitality so that they can attack the next day. So fun isn't just this whimsical act, right? What it is, it's really sort of the building blocks for you to live your best life. And again, that's not just rhetoric, right? I mean, you know, we have a lot of proof to prove that now.
Your book made me think about the aptness of the word recreation, which we don't necessarily break down into its component parts. In other words, we sort of recreate our will to do things that are harder.
We have that resilience to move on and sort of build this mosaic, this tapestry of life that becomes more interesting. And I think another thing is, like, once you feel that connection to something bigger than yourself, it allows you to have a broader purview of the things that you want to do. And then again, more experimentation and playfulness to sort of, you know, understand your world more.
We should probably talk a little more here, Mike, about what counts as fun in your book. When you say fun is immediate and biased toward action, what does that mean?
Yeah, so I mean, real quick, I try to cast a wide net, right? I think, you know, certainly this sort of, you know, boisterous activities, the Instagram influencer clicking their heels on the beach, right, is celebrated. And so I really think that fun is anything. In the book, I sort of explain that there's this psychological concept called valence, which essentially just means, are you enjoying yourself? And so fun is really anything that you're doing where you're enjoying the time that you're spending. And the reason that I call fun having this action bias is that essentially, if we want to engage in fun, generally we can do that in pretty short order. And a key component of what I found, because my initial research as a doctoral student was in workplace wellness, is how important autonomy is to our well-being. And so we talk about that in the context of work, but a lot of us are not, you know, applying it once the workday is over. And we know through self-determination theory how important that is. So fun really allows us to flex our autonomy, especially when we use, you know, our agency to be able to sort of take a transition from work and recapture some of our leisure time for ourselves to enjoy the time we have here on Earth.
Some of us really steeped in productivity culture might worry that a commitment to getting some fun into every day will somehow lead us away from ever getting anything completed. Your sense is that fun is in no way a gateway drug. So what is the relationship between regular experiences of fun and our ability to complete our work, which may be less fun?
Yeah, so I explain that in two ways. I'll make them both quick. One, I think we're at an era that leisure is going to, we're going to start to understand leisure in a way that we understood sleep sort of at the end of the 90s, right? You remember in hustle culture, sleep deprivation was where we wore it on our sleeves as a badge of honor, right? You know, the Gary V's of the world. And again, I always qualify that Gary V's walked this back. I think he's doing a great job kind of course correcting, you know, the motivation that he used to give. But, you know, hey, you know, if you want to hustle, stop watching the shows that you like, put the kids to bed and then work till 3 a.m. and start it all over again. And we now know, you know, it's in the common vernacular how asinine that is, right? If you're not getting 7 hours of sleep at least a night, then you're not going to be productive the next day. And so, you know, obviously we don't talk about sleep deprivation anymore. We're now learning the same about leisure, right? I mean, just on LinkedIn, I think it was last week, different stats were highlighted, you know, in the book. Historically, it's always been the same that we're second to last in the developed world with regards to the amount of PTO we get. And even that, you know, at 2 weeks, again, which has us coming in second to last, I think there's one other country that only offers 9 per year of work, you know, that we're not even using it. 50% of the folks that get 2 weeks don't even take their vacation. So that's a problem. And there's a pretty direct line from that to burnout, right? So recent stats just came out from the American Psychological Association that 1 in 4 are so burnt out, they don't even know how to use their time. They don't know how to get started. And so going back to, you know, this idea that we don't talk about sleep deprivation, you know, as a badge of honor anymore, I think we're going to see the same with leisure, that folks, you know, especially now in knowledge work where there is no transition between the office to home, how much that is burning us out. I mean, we almost started to understand that. Arianna Huffington did such a great job right before the pandemic, you know, with her own personal story. And there were a lot of interesting conversations going on. And then the pandemic just kind of blew up the world, blew up work in general, right? With work at home and all of our schedules changing and, you know, again, kind of falling down Maslow's triangle, as it were. But, you know, we've come out of the pandemic and these problems are still there. And so understanding how important it is to recharge your batteries, you know, to have a little bit of life taken for yourself so that you can live a life outside of work becomes extremely important. The second way I like to describe it for folks that are more, you know, have a more quantitative slant is that, you know, just a simple math problem. So if you're grinding things out, if you're someone that thinks busy and admin work is, you know, quote unquote work, and so you're working 60 hours a week, and let's say you produce 1 unit of output, right? Okay, great. That's 60 units of output. That's probably more than someone, you know, is working 40 hours a week. But these folks that are really deliberately living their life and recharge their batteries are able to produce a lot more. So that hypothetically, let's say it's 2x. So for 40 hours of work, they're actually producing 80 units of output and they're living a lot funner life, right? And so here you are kind of living this life of martyrdom, thinking you're working because you're always busy, but you're not. And what we know, you know, folks that follow Bronnie Ware and others that have looked at, you know, people that live these really busy lives and then are kind of left to look back at their life, I mean, they regret those habituated lives where they didn't, you know, really experience anything but work.
If we all understand by now that endless scrolling is really not fun, why do we keep filling our free time that way when we could be doing something we enjoy more?
Yeah, I think, you know, to give us a little bit of grace, I mean, it's one of the easiest, most accessible ways to mitigate boredom, right? But we know that it essentially doesn't lead to betterment or fulfillment. It certainly doesn't make us feel invigorated, right? And so I don't villainize social media as much as others, because I certainly think it's a great way to connect. My daughter's in gymnastics right now, and I love posting pictures of her so that, you know, our family can see them, because there's no other way. So I think those opportunities for connection are still valuable and for me fun. But I think, you know, for me in particular, I got addicted to doom scrolling during the pandemic, because I would just, you know, look at news article after news article, which was essentially saying the same thing. And so one of the things that I suggest is, if you do enjoy those activities, don't cut them out, but just give yourself a time block to do them. Say, I'm only going to do this for 30 minutes, and then recapture, you know, the rest of the time, because they really have been designed, you know, they call it the attention economy for a reason, right? They've been designed to capture our attention, because our attention is what lines their pockets with money, right? That's been well documented. And so that's fine. There is this exchange of value. I mean, I value these platforms to be able to share interesting ideas and moments of time with others. But the way they've been designed is to capture my attention even when I don't want to give it up. And so being mindful of your use becomes important.
Mike, you suggest we create a short list of things that are fun for us. And I have to ask, why a short list rather than one that's maybe dozens of entries long?
Yeah, I fall back on the paradox of choice. Anyone that's read that book will know where this science comes from. But when we have an overwhelming list, it can tend to essentially just sit there, right? I mean, brainstorming is so fun, but if you get overwhelmed, you know, with the amount of choices, then sometimes it can kind of be paralysis by analysis. And so, you know, this isn't really anything that's, you know, more than pedestrian, but if you shorten the list to 8 to 15 things that you're pretty confident you could put into play, generally you will take action a lot more than if you kind of had, you know, this long sort of creative list of fanciful things and, you know, things that were kind of all over the place. And so the reasoning behind that is that when we have lists from 8 to 15 things, we tend to feel better about that list, and they also become more actionable.
We might assume if our time is relatively limited for fun, we want a guarantee of fun every time we set out to obtain it. But how does uncertainty play into the experience?
Yeah, I think it's clear that spontaneity and surprise and these moments that are whimsical, so they, you know, become memorable, are, you know, we call this rich encoding, right? And so we know when things are sort of out of the ordinary, they're going to be things that we remember more. And so I really like this frame, you know, it's a little bit of a tangent, but, you know, getting outside of the need to really be outcome focused. So you find folks that you know, maybe planned this huge skiing vacation and the snow was, you know, so overwhelming that they couldn't get to the slopes. But because of that spontaneity, because they had to act on the fly to kind of figure out how they were gonna have their fun, they had these amazing moments within a cabin, right? And like, they'll never forget that. You remember that one time that we got snowed in, you know, versus, you know, kind of the other avenue where you don't reframe it in that fashion. You're just, this vacation sucked. I can't believe we spent all this money to fly here and now we're stuck in this cabin. And so I think finding those opportunities, you know, for surprise, for spontaneity, is not only really great when it just happens serendipitously, but also looking for it when things kind of go south. Like how, you know, again, not being Pollyanna about it, but how can we kind of change this so we can make the best use of this crazy thing that's happening?
My husband and I have gotten to where occasionally when we're on vacation or just at home and we get served a really bad meal in a restaurant, rather than lamenting that we've wasted our time and money, we laugh and laugh and laugh about the quality of the service and the quality of the food. And I'm hesitant to say this, but we almost enjoy it more than a meal where everything's perfect.
I think that's right. I'm similar with really bad movies. You know, like my wife's like, "What are we gonna watch this?" And then we start to lampoon it. You know, we essentially become those two Muppets up on the terrace. And yeah, so I think that's the best. And it's really just, you know, sort of accepting what has happened and then looking for these, you know, kind of surprise moments. And it's even better when you can connect with someone that's on board, for sure. But I mean, just so that I don't skirt it, I think it's, you know, making sure that you are scheduling, you know, things to happen increases the probability for spontaneity. So that's another, you know, thing that I touch on in the book, is that, you know, they may not happen all the time, but if you are, you know, let's say it's something out in nature, right? Like if you're taking a hike a few more times a year, then your chances for, you know, amazing sort of, you know, experience of awe and wonder in nature is going to obviously increase. And so wherever you find your joy and delight, making those opportunities more prevalent in your life become important for these opportunities to come forth, right? And so, you know, again, I'm not suggesting organizing a life, you know, where you're going off to every music festival, right? For, you know, any Burning Man that's out there. What I am suggesting is that right now here, especially in the US, we need a radical corrective, because so many of us have just habituated in our life, you know, habituated our lives in a way that we're not doing much at all with regards to inviting joy and delight in.
Now with remote work, lots of people love the idea that they can sort of not take any vacation time at all, but go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. You actually really think it's important to not work full stop during a vacation?
I mean, there are two aspects there. I certainly think if you can work in an interesting place, as long as you have transition rituals, then that gives you like this amazing opportunity to operate within that space. One of the folks that was helping me promote the book lived in Bali. And so that was an absolutely amazing experience for her, because when her workday ended at 5, she was in Bali. So what I advocate for is that you need this transition ritual. What you're talking about is a component in the book of folks that still answer emails when they're finally taking that 1 week off a year. So if you're essentially allowing yourself to be on, then that vacation has become an extension of work, because those are really meant to be opportunities to really shut down. And for some reason, that message is just not being heard here in the US. There are multiple countries in the EU that are now shutting down work email servers at 5 on Friday, because they know how insidious it is to work through the weekend. So you literally can't send an email, you know, after 5 on a Friday, because they're protecting that break for you. But we just don't do enough of that here. And so to get back to your question, if you're allowing yourself to still be accessible, a lot of times people will take advantage of that. Oh yeah, you know, Mike's still online, just hit him up. Hmm. And so making sure, again, whether that transition ritual is at 5 p.m. every day, so you at least have, you know, again, going back to those 2 hours that you can enjoy yourself a little bit, to these big trips where you're investing a lot of time and money. And again, we could fall back on privilege. Like a lot of us are spending an immense amount of resource to have these opportunities to really enjoy our life, and then allowing work to creep in becomes quite problematic, because then you go back to the office and essentially you were there the whole time anyways.
A lot of us, Mike, I think, draw a dividing line between that which is fun and that which is meant to be serious. How can fun be used in service to good causes, like raising money for research into a serious disease?
Yeah, so what I found in my research, and again, this is, I love the prompt, because ultimately I did write the book for the individual, but I also found that this is very true for folks that are engaged in philanthropy. When you add elements of fun, you don't burn out, right? And so what I talk about in the book is that there's so many of these world problems that are not going to get solved in our lifetime, right? And that can be extremely overwhelming. And so having a strong basis of resilience really is required for folks that are trying to be change makers in the world. And so one of the things that I highlight in the book is how successful the ALS bucket challenge was, right? Here was something that, you know, was focused on something that's truly awful. The two people that invented it ultimately ended up dying from the disease. So we're not trying to look at this in a humorous way, but because they enabled people to give back in such a fun way, and not only fun, but a great example of autonomy too, right? They didn't say, this is how you have to do the challenge. Actually, these are just the rules of the game. Now go have fun with it, right? It was one of the most successful charitable events of all time. And so having a little bit of fun allows you to still do the hard work. And then for the philanthropist, again, this is in the book, but I did study it for the book, is that when there are elements of fun, whether that be a gala, whether that be something like the ALS challenge, you just attract so many other folks. They tend to return the next year. They tend to give more. You know, when you burden people with these problems, they become so heavy, and people certainly want to help, but eventually they're going to drown, right? Just, you know, the same reason that a lifeguard generally doesn't go out to a drowning victim without some sort of flotation device, you know, fun can be that same sort of life-saving thing with regards to some of these really big, heady problems.
Many of us have had the most fun of our lives in the company of our favorite people. How do we cultivate fun friendships?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really requires invitation, right? So you certainly don't want to take stock in those friendships, but I think creating those opportunities becomes important. You know, it's sort of a theme that we talked about throughout our conversation, is that we do need to be a little bit deliberate. And so identifying the friends that you always feel lit up when you're around, you know, like the experience that you talked about with your husband, I bet there's also friends that you have, right, that you're with them through thick and thin, no matter what, you're always coming out of the activity laughing. And so making sure that you're connecting with those folks. There's been a ton of research that, you know, I bring it up in the chapter of how difficult it does become as adults, because we move away. A big part of friendship is commonality and shared experience, and that becomes harder and harder as our schedules become so busy. So making sure that we connect with those. If you're an introvert, it might just be one or two friends. For me, again, I'm extroverted. So for me, it's connecting with a group of high school friends through something as simple as fantasy football, so that we have these reoccurring opportunities for us to really connect, laugh, share jokes, and you know, continue the fun, hopefully until you know, to the end of our lives.
Do your kids see you as like the fun dad?
I have a fresh answer for this. So I think they do, but they're so sick of 6 years of research in this topic. I'll give you two anecdotes that are hopefully humorous, because I think they're great. They both come from my daughter. So one, she's like, "You finally found a way to suck the fun out of fun." You just heard me talk about it so much. I thought that was great. You know, she's probably right. But then the thing that's a little bit more endearing is that she likes my voice, and I found we've co-slept with our kids for quite some time, probably too long. It's probably for a different podcast, right? But so my daughter's really, she's now 10, so she's really trying to sleep train herself. And I found out that she's listening to these podcasts to be able to go to sleep, because she finds my voice soothing, but at the same time, she finds the repetitive nature of everything that I've shared so boring that it puts her to sleep.
Mike Rucker is an organizational psychologist and charter member of the International Positive Psychology Association. His book is The Fun Habit: How the Pursuit of Joy and Wonder Can Change Your Life. Mike, thanks so much for telling us about this.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a true pleasure.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.